We made this.
Stephen Strange. Might I offer you some advice? Forget everything that you think you know.
You're a man looking at the world through a keyhole. You've spent your life trying to widen it. Your work saved the lives of thousands. What if I told you that reality is one of many?
I don't believe in fairy tales about chakras or energy or the power of belief.
You wonder what I see in your future? Possibility.
Why are you doing this?
There are other ways to save lives. So much you don't know.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to podcast 616, the Marvel podcast on the We Made This Podcast Network. My name is Kurt North, and I am here today to talk about a film from 2016. We're not far away from the second Doctor Strange movie, Multiverse of Madness, coming out, and we're going to have a flick back in time, which is quite appropriate for this film. And joining me to discuss this first film, Doctor Strange, is Robert Turnbull. Robert, how are we doing?
Oh, very good. Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here, which sounds like a fake platitude, but I do honestly mean it. I wish I hadn't said it now. I'm so pleased to be here.
I am pleased to be here because I asked to do this podcast. I'm not pleased to be here because I've had a horrific week, and I know that you've been busy as well. So I've literally, as of 10-15 minutes ago, just finished flicking through this film again for the second time in as many weeks, and have made uncopious notes, if that's even a word. So have you fared any better? I know you've been busy as well, so have you fared much better than that?
I actually had watched this film only a few months ago, just for fun, as one does with films. But I did manage to watch, because I've been crazy busy the last few weeks, even in the build up to this. But I did manage to watch it this afternoon, and I sort of properly watched it as well. I managed to properly squeeze it in and sit down and watch it. And I made, let's say, uncopious notes as well.
Yeah. I'm going to have to search on Google at the end of this and just go, is that even a word?
Let's trademark it if it's not.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this was written by Scott Derrickson and written by John Spaeth and Scott Derrickson, as well as Robert Cargill. See, Robert Cargill. It aired on November the 4th, 2016. And I was just having a very quick look, actually, see where this fell in the Marvel Universe, because around this time, I remember that I was kind of getting that, and I think a lot of people were getting this Marvel fatigue at some point. So this came out around about the time of Civil War and Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Mm-hmm. I think I'd seen every single movie from that point up until Ant-Man. So I got as far as Avengers Age of Ultron, which will have a link, obviously, to Multiverse of Madness with them. And this is their bingo cards being shouted out, Wanda. Since that I am a bit of a Wanda fan. But so it was Age of Ultron was 2015, and I missed Ant-Man. And I don't know why I missed Ant-Man, but
it's because he's tiny. It's hard to see him.
That's very true. That's very true. And obviously Civil War and then Guardians of the Galaxy 2. So yeah, it's an interesting time for Marvel. We're just hitting the second film in Phase 3 as well. So there's, it's had some time behind it here. Just before we kick off into that, the second film's coming out very soon. It's coming out in a couple of weeks. How have you found the trailers and things like that for the Multiverse of Madness? And are you looking forward to that one?
So I tend to avoid trailers. So
right, okay.
I've seen one trailer. I genuinely can't remember I genuinely can't remember which trailer it was. It may have been the second or the however many there are out now. I've seen one of them.
Right. Okay.
But I'm really excited about it. I'm excited about it for multiple reasons. Partly because I like Doctor Strange. I'm a Doctor Strange fan. This particular film seems to be bringing back a lot of actors that I just really enjoy watching as actors, regardless of whether it's Marvel. But also, I'm just a fucking Sam Raimi fanatic. I adore Sam Raimi.
Right.
They've recently done, for Real Talk, I've done the Sam Raimi Top 10, which we've done in two parts. So check those out if you want to hear exactly what I love about Sam Raimi. So yeah, for various reasons, I'm really, really excited about this film. But that's kind of why I've avoided the trailer. So I've seen one trailer and I was sort of happy that it was just sort of little flashes and movements and it didn't give too much away. And I sort of tried not to overabsorb it.
What I tend to do with trailers is that I do watch them, but I don't pay that much attention to the online thing of it.
Well, yes, now, definitely.
That's... I think there has been some things that I've been aware of in the Elon Musk sphere, as we now call it.
The musky haze.
The musky haze sphere, you know, where I'm like, do I really want to know that? Would I like to have been surprised by that kind of thing? And not necessarily massive spoilers, but it's stuff like, I'm not sure. I probably would have preferred to have seen that off, at the cinema itself. Mm. Yeah, there's a few bits like that. I do think it does look wonderful and... As we'll talk about in this episode, with Doctor Strange, the first one itself, is that I'm a big fan of things like Inception, of the Nolan stuff, anything that Nolan does, mm-hmm. For example. And there's a lot to touch on with Christopher Nolan in Doctor Strange, you know, Inception, and in a particular one, Tenet is even like, even though this is before Tenet, it still has things in there with regards to it. I love abstract, films, so. You know, anything like Mulholland Drive and things from David Lynch. So I'm a huge kind of that kind of abstract fan, as opposed to something like Harry Potter, which I'm not a fan of. So it looks like it's going to be wonderful, and I just love some of the visuals that I've seen of that. So it's just, as I say, just waiting for a couple of weeks now before we can actually dive in and see what that's like. But we are here to talk about the first film, Doctor Strange.
Yes.
I just wanted to get your first opinions on this, because... The actual casting was an interesting one. I don't know if you've read anything on the casting at all, but there was a lot of people up for this. I think, but even so, Benedict Cumberbatch was one of the first people that was thought of. But a lot of people. Have you seen the list of people that that might have been included on here?
Oh no, I don't. I mean, I remember at the time there was a lot of chatter about it, and there were a few names that were coming up in particular. A lot,
yeah.
But especially not in the last sort of like 4 or 5 years, I haven't checked it out. Are there some weird ones on there?
There's likes of Tom Hardy, I think, was one. They reportedly looked at likes of Jared Leto, Tom Hardy. Mm-hmm. They were looking at people like Ryan Gosling, Ethan Hawke, Oscar Isaac, Ewan McGregor, Matthew McConaughey, Colin Farrell, Keanu Reeves as well was on the shortlist.
Yeah,
short
I think
list.
I remember that one, yeah.
Keanu Reeves was the one that jumped out at me, I must admit, out of all of them. So, yeah, it's a lot to do, but I think the thing what fascinates me about that is I can't imagine anyone but Benedict Cumberbatch being Doctor Strange. I don't know about you.
No, I'm kind of similar with you, and it's weird because I remember at the time, I got into some sort of, what would we call them, heated discussions on Twitter with a few people who, I saw a lot of people basically saying that they didn't think it was good casting, and a lot of people giving the reason that they thought it was too obvious. Like, Benedict Cumberbatch, that's really obvious. I'd have liked it if they'd gone for a more interesting choice. It's like, why is it too, like, if he's obvious, then why not give him the, if you're looking at this guy and saying, oh my goodness, he's so perfect for the role, it's obvious, then why is it a bad thing to give him the part? And yeah. Because Doctor Strange, I don't actually think Benedict Cumberbatch is that obvious.
Right.
Because when you look at the comic books, like a lot of comic book characters, he is kind of, he's big and he's buff and he's strong, like comic book characters are. And Cumberbatch isn't quite that. But his sort of face and his demeanor, I can't picture anyone else. It's like, it's a bit like way, way back when Robert Downey Jr. was first announced, I'd never even thought of Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. The moment I heard, I was just like, fucking hell, of course. Of course. Yeah. And it's similar with Benedict Cumberbatch. It's like, I wouldn't necessarily have gone, right, I'm going to write my list of names. As soon as I'd heard it was him, I was like, well, of course it is. Of course it's him. He looks like Doctor Strange.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that it's... I mean, we're both Star Trek fans as well. I mean, I love the fact that Benedict Cumberbatch was going to be in Star Trek 2. You know, The Wrath of Khan. Oh, no, sorry, Into Darkness.
Into Shitness.
But yeah, spoiler alert. I was fascinated by it, and I know there was a massive thing about Khan and things like that. And I was just like, I don't care. Benedict Cumberbatch is in it. He's great.
I love him.
You know, I've seen him do performances on stage, you know, and stuff like that. And he's just an amazing actor. And so I was all for it. You know, I was like, right, okay, Cumberbatch has got it for me. He's in the bag. Fantastic. You know, that will do. Absolutely fine. Not a problem whatsoever. I'm not a huge fan of the comic books themselves as a reader. I don't really read comic books. But for some reason, Doctor Strange for me is actually in the ether for some reason. I don't know if it's from TV shows growing up as a kid, but Doctor Strange was a character that I kind of remember quite well, as well as the... I'd say like the yellow Wolverine, for example, in X-Men. I think there's certain things that just do jump out at me. You know, I'm still waiting for the remake of Batthink. I know that's quite random. But...
I would love that. But you know what? I think Doctor Strange, though, there's something interesting about it, because I think that he's a character that has been parodied a lot. So before the MCU became a big thing, before comic book movies were as big as they are now, most people on the street wouldn't necessarily know the character of Doctor Strange. Yeah. Not in the same way they would Spider-Man or Hulk. But I think that actually lots and lots of kind of like, you know, especially kind of like Adult Swim cartoon shows, that kind of thing. I think there was a lot of Doctor Strange parody around, even though he wasn't necessarily that well known. So I get what you mean about him maybe being in the ether and the character and the visual. I think that's really it. The visual of Doctor Strange, I think, is more prominent than maybe the character was himself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's probably the good call, actually. That's probably what it is. The fact that is he's got an iconic look about him where, you know, I don't remember ever seeing a Vision. I don't remember ever seeing the Scarlet Witch, although Scarlet Witch, the name, I can kind of remember. But a lot of the stuff was really X-Men. It was more Cyclops and Wolverine and stuff like that I remember more than anything else, really, which is, you know, so definitely more the X-Men kind of stuff, really. But yeah, the general look, I think, is the reason why I remember it so well. Just regards to your general thoughts on the film itself, then, what do you make to it then? Where would it kind of rate in your list of Marvel films that have been out to date?
Oh man, I mean, so generally speaking, I actually really like it. We're gonna pick it apart a bit now, and I'm gonna obviously go into a lot of detail of the things that don't work for me or that I don't think are quite so good about it, especially having just watched it this afternoon with a more critical eye. Generally speaking, I kind of like it. I don't know where it would rank. I mean, I guess there's 20 odd movies. It probably falls somewhere in the middle. it's not right at the top. It's not right at the bottom. The thing for me is that I actually think it's a really good origin movie. I think that the MCU actually makes good origin movies. Yeah. And I think that what maybe worked against this film at the time was that we'd had several characters build up. We'd had origin movies, and then we had a couple of Avengers movies. And I think people had sort of forgotten about origin movies, because we'd had other characters, you know, Spider-Man, Black Panther had been kind of sideloaded in without having to have their own big movie. And I think people had kind of forgotten about origin movies. So when this came along, I think some people were almost a bit resentful, or they'd been sort of thrown by the fact, it's like, oh, why do we have to watch origin movies? It's like, we've done origin movies. Why can't we just hit the ground running?
Yeah.
But I think it's a really good origin movie. I think it tells the story. I think it introduces the characters. The arc that he goes on, I think, is really good. And I probably find it more rewatchable than, say, maybe Captain America First Avenger, possibly even Thor. I think I find it more rewatchable than them. So if I take it out of the whole 20 plus movies and maybe put it into a with just the origin movies for the characters that had origin movies, it maybe ranks number 3.
Okay.
In those. If that's a more precise...
No, that makes sense. I think what you're saying, because I think Ant-Man, as I say, I still haven't watched Ant-Man, and I don't understand, because it's on the DVD wall that's right next to me.
Oh, it's great.
I could reach it. and it's not... I don't think it's any offence to the movie, because it's like... The stuff I've seen since, you know, it's... You know, it's fine. I've just recently watched Shang-Chi because, again, I had a bit of a fatigue-ness about some of the stuff that I was watching.
Yeah, for sure.
So I've kind of took a bit of a step back. I actually watched recently the last Spider-Man and I've watched Shang-Chi and I still got to watch Eternals. And there's only Ant-Man that I haven't watched. So I need to complete it, really. Well, Eternals and Ant-Man, effectively.
First. Just no, actually, no. Watch it afterwards. It's more fun.
Just get through the dearth of like. So Ant-Man was 2015, and this was 2016. So those are effectively. I'm assuming Ant-Man's pretty much an origin story, is it?
Yeah, I mean it is. Yeah. It is pretty much. It's probably a little bit wider. Its net is probably a little bit wider in terms of. Bringing characters in, but it's pretty much an origin story.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think again, leaning on bias that because of Benedict Cumberbatch, I think I'd rate it not necessarily slightly higher, but I think it's good to like kind of point it in that direction of like origin stories, because that's one of the things I was going to speak about actually about how it's there's like the well known monomyth kind of Joseph Campbellian story, Hero's Journey, which is this. Film to a T, you know. Basically loses everything, goes on a journey, kind of his mentor dies, and then he finds worth at the end of it. It's kind of like the perfect
textbook
story, really. there's nothing there, you know, really kind of like jumps out at going, oh, that was unique. But we will delve into some of the uniqueness of this film. So I think that for me, I think it's up there, definitely up there. It's not going to be a Guardians of the Galaxy, it's not going to be an Avengers movie. Speaking of Captain America, one of my favourite movies of the Marvel stuff is The Winter Soldier. I think it's just an amazing movie. One of my worst movies is The First Avenger.
So
I've got a complete split for those two films. I'd say it's probably above halfway, quite significantly above halfway, maybe in the first third, I think.
Cool, yeah.
So it's good to take it from there. So as I say, it is an introduction to Strange. The first scene I think is done marvelously well. We're not going to go scene by scene. We're just going to generally talk about it. But
all these notes I've made, scene by scene.
No. I've told you, I'm not doing that. even though I probably will end up doing that because my notes are in order. Because I was going skip 15 seconds. Oh yeah, that bit. But the first scene in the ER room. Where, you know, we learn a lot about Stephen Strange.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where there's a lot of show and there's a lot of like show don't tell. You know, there's a lot of that in this. And I think the problem with movies that generally have to have a lot of exposition is they struggle to be able to do that. And I think out of all the ones, I think this one does quite really well in doing that. And yes, there's the Ancient One stuff later on, which still think does it well. But I think this part of the movie actually is probably the strongest part for doing that without doing too much exposition. Would you agree with that?
No, I would actually. And I was thinking it especially watching it today with the sort of the critical goggles on, I was thinking very much, there's a thing which, you know, a lot of the MCU movies do, which this one does, which is to give you a little bit of a sort of fantastical, almost like pre-titles scene. You cold open, basically. And then it goes into something a bit more mundane as we build the plot up so that you don't lose interest at the start, but you don't hit the ground running. Which this one does. There's a little bit of Mads Mikkelsen at the very beginning. And then we come in with Stephen and he's, you know, the surgery and we meet Christine and everyone. And I think it's fantastic. I mean, at that sort of whatever it is, like first 15 minutes or so, I think is really... really strong and really well constructed. And the opening scene in particular with the, you know, her getting the second opinion, I think is tells us so much about him. and everything up to his accident, and then her, you know, his loneliness, her looking after him, him pushing her away. I mean, I could talk for hours about the scene where he pushes her away. I think it's a brilliant scene.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is that if this were a Hallmark Channel movie, I'd be watching this going, this is so fucking cheesy. But here in context, I'm like, this is so perfect, because you're not watching anything fantastical or supernatural at all. You're watching a drama about an arrogant surgeon who injures himself, loses literally everything and everyone. The only few people and things he has around him, he just pushes everything away, destroys everything. Through and the best thing is that it's almost like it's less to do with his arrogance. It's the mistake. It's you know, his accident is because of a mistake, which actually anyone could make. It's like how, you know, the sort of carelessness of his accident. So I love it. I think the first scene, like you say, and I think the first sort of 15 or so minutes that establish him, then take everything away and strip him down to that point that he goes on his journey proper. I think is brilliant. And actually the music, not to digress, I'm cards on the table, and I know lots of people out there will be going, I'm not a huge Michael Giacchino fan. Yeah. Not really a big fan of his. And we'll probably, maybe a bit later, it'll be appropriate to talk about the sort of the Doctor Strange theme and the music as we get into it. But I actually think that the best part of the music is this opening sequence.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel like a comic book movie. It doesn't have any of the tinkly Doctor Strange stuff going on. It actually just sounds like the soundtrack to a medical drama.
Yeah.
So especially as someone who has very mixed feelings on Giacchino, I think that the soundtrack in the opening of this film really, really complements it and sells that whole kind of, that whole world that he inhabits. He doesn't live in the world of the Avengers yet. He lives very much in our world at that beginning part, and I think that's great.
Yeah, I'm just looking at something actually, because I forgot to look at this, but just on the music, there was something that I noted in that first scene about the things with the ticking time and clock on the watch and things like that. That felt like, and it was done a year later, so again, I can't, you know, I'm just looking at things backwards rather than think. Maybe Doctor Strange did this, and I don't know. But reminded me of Dunkirk, you know, there's that ticking, like, sort of motion of, like, you've got this clock. And I think the way that it's done with the scene of, like, you're trying to save someone's life and having that ticking time bomb, like, sort of, like, clicking in, and it only really stops when, you know, Strange is sitting there and he's going, can you cover your watch, please? And then it stops. And I thought that was really quite genius from a sound design point of view.
I think, you know what?
So,
I mean, it's weird, because I have complete opposing opinions on different parts of this score. And there is another part later on in it, not to jump ahead or to digress. There's another part where they're fighting in the street and every time is reversing, where the soundtrack and the sound design, the music it includes music that's got in that soundscape, which I think, again, is brilliant. That, you know, this opening sequence and that part, I think it's really clever, which is probably why I get extra frustrated at some of the other music in this movie.
Well, you know, I'm sure we'll come to them. But like you say, the things that really kind of showed it to me and, you know, kind of like had that show don't tell aspect, was things like when he was getting really down and out, that his apartment became more and more sparse.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
You know, that's, and it took maybe one line. I think he says something like, where I think it was even Christine that says something along the lines of, like, you've given everything. Because his arrogance in some lines were like things like, you know, it's expensive and such, and he's like, well, it's fine. It's, you know, the expensive wasn't even mentioned, you know, on his retort back. I can't remember exactly what was said there. But he said something along those lines anyway. It's like, you know, I can do, you know, exploratory surgery, for example, but expensive doesn't really matter. And I love the fact they left the actual word expensive out. Mm. It was actually the woman talking to him. which I thought was really good. And just like little things like, you know, just to show how it, like his photographic mind, which then comes into play later, mm-hmm. where he's then talking about the hits of the music that he's listening to and what year it was. It was actually December 1977 instead of, you know, 78 and things like that. Just really worked. And then things just to show how cold he is and how less empathy that he has and how dedicated he is to his task or his job. That the job is all about going to those dinners. The job is all about getting the trophies. The job is all about, you know, becoming the best surgeon he can possibly do and can possibly be. And we see that distilled in the episode. See, Marvel's done it for me now. It's not done TV episodes and films. You see it in the film, you know, where Doctor Strange actually does say, you know, I've taken a man's life, and that's not the thing to do. I draw the line at killing somebody. But at the same time, at this moment in time when we're watching him, you know, he's the one that, like, sort of turns away from people who need his help in the car and at the basketball court, mm-hmm. where he's going, you know, no, not interested. It's nothing to do with me. That's not going to enhance my career by any stretch of the imagination. And it becomes a thing, a personal property of his, that he wants the ones that kind of deal with his arrogance. And even to the point where, you know, he does save that person's life. And when he comes in, when they come in for a hug with him, he just sort of spins away.
Yes, I love that.
And stuff like that. I just think the way that that's told is just brilliant movie making and brilliant way to show don't tell.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a very good example of exactly that, show not tell. And I know this film kind of got a lot of comparisons to the first Iron Man movie. And I love the first Iron Man movie. And yeah. I think, but the very big difference, apart from the fact that we've grown as an audience consuming the MCU movies, and they've grown as a producer in terms of how they work the stories and stuff. But you're looking at very different things. You know, you kind of think, oh, well, you know, he's just a magic version of Tony Stark. And it's like, yeah, but actually Tony Stark, that movie is, Iron Man 1 is very tell not show a lot of the time, but it works in context because it's a sort of a patter comedy almost. The dialogue is constant.
Yeah.
And it kind of works with the character of Tony Stark, who is constantly explaining to people what he's doing because he wants to be clever and he wants to seem clever. Whereas someone like Stephen Strange, he doesn't want to constantly tell people. He wants to show them. He wants people to see him, witness him, and then he wants to be aloof and not say anything and not give a proper hug and walk away. So I think you're right. I think it's like, it's not just that it's a good example of show not tell in movie making. I think narratively it's appropriate for the character to not talk about what he's doing, to not explain it out loud, and, you know, the other characters that he interacts with.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, because it does, you know, just the way that they actually play around with that, you know, and actually, you know, as I say, you know, just the fact that he does words that not ascend, and it gives you the impetus of, like, just how focused he is, because he'll set himself a task, and you have to do it for Stephen Strange, because at the end of the day, they're protecting that realm, which is not what the Avengers are doing, and it makes a point of saying that, mm-hmm. that they're protecting a realm, and he falls into that, and eventually, you know, you've got, like, the perfect juxtaposition of the character who is using the magic to keep himself just on the basketball court. But then you've got Stephen Strange, who won't go. He needs to go further than that. He needs to understand and go to the end degree with that, and that's what he does. And I think that having that juxtaposition of the two, that someone who doesn't want to really get it explained and just goes, right, I'm happy with my life at the moment, I'm content. That's not the way Stephen Strange is. He's not content with that, because it's not the end of the road. There's more things to get down. You can imagine him, once he gets into a position, that he will fall down that route, because he just wants to find out more and more and more. And we see that in the film.
It's the overachiever. And I love it. There is that sort of point within the movie, because it's like when he first arrives and he sort of begs, you know, to be shown and to be taught. And at this point, his main motivation is to fix his hands so that he can become the surgeon that he is again. But then there's that moment where because obviously, you know, the magic isn't clicking for him for so long. It takes a while. He can't do it. It's not working. Then there's the moment where it clicks for him. And as a character, as a person, Stephen Strange, instead of going, right, I now can do the magic so I can fix my hands, he goes, right, I can do magic, so I have to be the best person at magic ever. Yeah. And there's that moment, he styles his hair and he has his shave, and then he, like, you know, starts basically being an arrogant prick again.
Yeah.
But this time about magic. And I love that. I really like it because it, again, I feel that the film has shown us, it's shown us appropriately that that is what the character would do. He wouldn't, you know, as soon as he realized that he could do magic, he would want to and have to, like, compulsively need to be the best possible magician out there, sorcerer out there, you know?
You even take it one step further towards the end of the film. And when you talk about the Infinity Stone, and he looks at his hands as if to say, I could actually reverse time and sort my hands out.
Mm.
And he makes that decision not to. And I think that is the arc. That's the kind of thing of, like, that's where he started from to where he gets to.
That's it.
It's great. And it's a look. And again, it's a look. It's not, let's go, oh, you can fix your hands just by reversing time. It's like, no, I think I'm all right. And I just love that.
No, I agree. And I think that's the sort of the overall arc, isn't it? That he realizes that, in a wonderful, arrogant way, yeah, being a surgeon, that's no good anymore. That's rubbish. Leave that for lesser mortals. I'm going to go and be, you know, a multidimensional world-saving sorcerer.
What do you think to the humour in the film then? Because he starts off with quite dark humour, and then you get thing, because I know there's been a few conversations about it being a bit hit and miss with, like, so the Beyoncé stuff and Adele and stuff like that, which is a bit more Marvel. But some of the dark humour at the beginning was quite nice, and just, and I think that's one of the reasons why I quite like this film as well, is because it isn't afraid to, like, look at some of the darker elements of a film, because, you know, you look at The Crash, for example, and just how visceral that crash is. And you've seen even, like, the crushing of the hands. You only see it for a brief second. Great editing, because you don't want to see the entire thing in slow motion. You don't want to see it too quickly. You kind of see it go in and then just it crushes you. But Stephen Strange does have dark humour. So it is interesting to see that. But then the juxtaposition again of, like, some of the lighter stuff with the Adele stuff, I'm not sure it works as well, apart from maybe the Beyoncé one, because you get Wong later on who is a bit lighter and has a bit more levity than what Stephen Strange does. But what did you make to that humour in the film?
I think it works okay. Well, for me, it works okay. I agree. I like the fact that he's got a sort of a darker sense of humour. Because he is the person who at a dinner party tells the darkly offensive joke that makes people go, oh, Stephen, you can't say that. You know, he is that person. And of course he is, because he wants to be the person who shocks and is outrageous. He wants to be the person who makes people feel uncomfortable in that way. So I find the humor's kind of okay, and I don't mind the slightly goofier stuff, particularly the whole Adele Beyoncé thing, because I think it's so beautifully constructed. I also think that, weirdly, I think that those little interactions of him sort of trying to get Wong to smile, basically.
Yeah.
I think it actually tells us a lot about the character of Wong. I think we get a lot of information about him in how he reacts, because you do quite clearly realise that he does have a sense of humour. He just has a greater control over it. So he sort of has the power, basically, that situation. You know, there is a line where, after several of their little interactions, Stephen says something along the lines of, you know, people always used to think I was funny, or I used to think I was funny. And Wong, it's the first time that Wong really sort of gets sassy, and he just says, oh, did that used to work for you? And it's brilliant, because I think it's in that moment you kind of go, oh, so actually Wong does have a sense of humor, and he just has a greater control of the situation than Stephen. It's like he's making, you know, he's taking the power there. And I don't mind the fact that it's kind of goofy. I don't mind the fact that it's the sort of, you know, running through single name people. Because even if you are going to make jokes about your own death and mortality, then then you're still going to make jokes about Adele.
That maybe says a bit more about you than it does anything else, mate. So as I say, is that Joseph Campbellian story? So when we're talking about the kind of the breakdown of him, you know, the accident is the literal breakdown of what he does, but he also breaks down in the relationship when he starts to lose, and I think Christine uses the words mania that. And I think it's a greatly filmed scene because obviously, as I say, the sparse nature of his apartment and, you know, you've got the window vista behind you and has that, as you say, that kind of Iron Man kind of feel to it, that he lives in this luxurious apartment but doesn't actually have anything left now and he's losing everything. And the way that he hits out against Christine, I thought was effective. So feel free to talk about that, because as I say, I know you've got a lot to say about that. But also I think what I find fascinating with the film is that it's only an hour and 55 minutes. Now, I think if this was filmed or done maybe 5 or 6 years later, I think the running time would be longer, because you don't get enough of the likes of Christine, I feel we needed a bit more of her. So what do you make to Christine's character and also that scene before we delve into her character a bit more?
Yeah, I mean, so likewise, I'd sort of forgotten how short it was in comparison. I'm not one of these...
I mean, it worked because I needed 1 hour 55. I couldn't do any quicker.
No, I'd forgotten that it was like under 2 hours. I think it's a really good, you know, it's a nice tight 2 hours. Although, yeah, I'll get on to Christine in a second. That scene, yeah, I really like that scene a lot. And I think the key thing that I like about it, apart from the fact that it's two very good, charismatic actors.
Yeah.
Like really sort of like getting into the nitty gritty. I like how it's kind of visceral, but it also doesn't hold back. There's absolutely no, there's no softening to it. So we've seen that he has no one, he has nothing, as in terms of people.
Yeah.
And Christine is the only person by his side. And the one thing that I do kind of like, and I'll expand on it in a moment, is the fact that they seem to be friends. Yeah. Like, you know, obviously they have, you know, they have dated briefly. You know, they both kind of reference the fact that it was very brief. It was very fleeting. But they've obviously found some kind of like relationship. It's like this is the only friend he has, basically. So I kind of like that about it. The fact that he just pushes her away.
Yeah.
And, you know, she has the line of like, this is the point, this is the moment where you apologize. She still gives him that opportunity to step back from being a prick, but he doesn't. He actually just pushes forward and he gets nastier and more cruel towards her. And she basically then says, you know, I'm done. That's it. And I think it's a really well written scene. I think that Christine has written very strongly in that, or she is written as strong rather in that scene, in her, you know, her decision just to leave. You know, there's no scene of her, there's no shot of her outside his door weeping into a hanky. She gets a little bit teary eyed, but basically says, yeah, fuck it. Yeah. But I also like the fact that when she leaves, there's no cringy moment of Stephen going, oh, Christine, oh no, what have I done? He just doesn't give a shit. She walks out and that's it. He just straight back to it.
Yeah.
So I really, really like how relentless the cruelty is in that moment. There's no let up. There's no give to it. There's no sign of his humility or his humanity yet. Because that's the realistic thing. I mean, I have had horrible, dark, dark times in my life where I've pushed people away. And in the moment that you push them away, you want to push them away. When they walk out the door, you don't suddenly regret it. It's days, weeks later that you actually regret those things, or you want to try and fix those things. So I really like that scene a lot. And it is everything that we were saying earlier about how it really genuinely builds up on just a sort of a straightforward melodrama.
Yeah.
Frankly, you know, if it was a whole film of that, it would be too much. It would be cheesy. But in building a platform for where he's going and the fantasy that we enter, I really like how almost mundane those first 15, 20 minutes are in terms of that very straight melodrama with two, you know, very good actors. You know, it's easy to make fun, but, you know, Cumberbatch is doing shouty acting. Rachel McAdams is doing sad acting, but they're doing that acting. It's, you know, they're properly doing it and they're very good at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality of the scenes up to that point, as you say, it's ER, medical drama. It's kind of, you know, there's like a scene I always think, because I'm a massive X-Files fan, this is all it is, that when they're walking down that corridor, I think that they could have made it like a new Mulder and Scully kind of, you know, or duo that have a good chemistry together.
Oh, I'd love that, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, but it does feel like that. It's kind of, you can imagine them to actually hold in something like a TV show like that. You know, you'd get things like Lucifer now, wouldn't you? Things like that that would hold up really well. And the characters are strong, you know, and I like the reality of like the whole thing. You know, you've got the Nick, yeah, you've got some of him, you've got Strange kind of like sort of showing Nick that, you know, you're actually, you know, I'm better than you, you know, you're an ER, mm-hmm. you know, surgeon, whatever. But he's like sitting saying, I'm better than you, you know, I'll do this, I'll show you who's boss and stuff. And you get people like that at work, you know, whether or not it's right now or if you've had it in the past, you know, in at work, you'll get people that are like that, that have that attitude, that, you know, or might be a bit obnoxious or arrogant in the way that they work and things. So it's, again, I think it lives in the real world, and I think that's what you're saying there. And I think that's what makes the abstract nature and the purples and stuff like that we see towards the back end, and even like sort of in the you know, the open the eye section in Camotage, work really effectively, because you start with quite, because one of the things for the very first scene I've got on my notes here is that when they're in the mirror realm, the contrast in color is quite astounding. That the actual scene is very Inception-esque. It's very kind of like sort of quite clean grey palette, but the yellow is kind of like really outstanding on the Ancient One.
Yeah.
It doesn't do the fantastic. It doesn't do what will happen in Camotage. It doesn't do what happens with Dormammu. It stays quite like abstract real, if that's the best way of describing it. I think it wants to stay in the real world to say there's something really weird going to happen soon, but you're going to go back to the real world for a bit. Mm-hmm. And then obviously when we get to Camotage, it does something different. So I like that. I like that lived in thing. And especially those scenes in the apartment, because it's quite dark. It's quite a dark scene, but it's also quite a darkly lit scene as well. The actual set itself is quite dark. And obviously playing with the light inside from the mirror window outside, which we'll get a reflection on. See, good little pun there. later on with the Ancient One, when they're actual projecting, because they're at the similar kind of view as such, which I thought works really well. So things like that they play with, I think it's been really well thought out in that regard. When we do get to the kind of like he goes to the basketball court, finds out that's where he finds the way to go to the next sort of stage. Actually, just before that, the arrogance, one of the biggest arrogant stuff that you see is like, I could have done this. I could have saved my own hands.
Yes.
You know, and how much that will play on his mind as well, that will definitely deepen and darken the soul. If you know that the only person that could have saved you is yourself, is quite a dark and wondrous way of actually putting it. I thought that was really effective. When they get to Kathmandu, then is this where things start to go a little bit awry with you, or do you still find it an interesting moment just before we get to Camotage? Or
I mean, I do enjoy it. I mean, I think, like, in terms of the things that I do and don't like about it, weirdly my kind of negatives are possibly more on a production side, and a couple of the characters maybe are underserved in terms of the progression of the story and how it moves along and you know, the stages that Steven goes through. I'm still happy, you know, I'm still happy with how it moves through, especially in the first two thirds.
Yeah.
You know, the first two acts, I'm very happy with how it moves along. I actually have a bit of a soft spot for when he finally gets there, because the film's got a real 80s aesthetic to it.
Right, yeah.
And I kind of like that about it. And it's, especially because actually it's quite, I remember this at the time when I first watched it, because it's quite detached from all the other Avengers movies, because there had been so many, you know, so many movies that I love, but all building up into the Avengers. Even, you know, Captain America's sequels were basically Avengers movies. Yeah. I know you've not watched Ant-Man, not to spoiler anything, but it's, you know, it's very connected to the Avengers.
Right.
That film, you know, that all the ties are there. You can feel that it's part of the family. Whereas this is actually really disconnected from the Avengers, a little bit like Shang-Chi, I think, was. And I kind of like that, and I enjoy it. I think that, especially considering how far into the movies that they are, this film actually stands by. You could watch this. This could be your first MCU movie.
Yeah.
And then you could sort of go back and get into the others. And I think that this one doesn't suffer from it. There's no constant callback other than, like, pretty much one line about the Avengers, pretty much. So yeah, it still works for me. I like this point. I like where he is, and I kind of like the slightly 80s aesthetic of it.
Well, let's delve into some of the stuff that you don't. I mean, one of the things I found fascinating on the last two watches is that I absolutely love time loop stories.
Mm-hmm.
I love them. I you know, Heaven Sent, Doctor Who, you know, one of my favorite
Fantastic.
Episodes of TV.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've talked about that.
I think we have, yes.
you know, and Cause and Effect, Star Trek Next Generation, you know, yeah. Groundhog Day. You've got all these kind of movies that have got ground loops in Monday on the X-Files. And the Dormammu thing, I honestly, in my head, when before watching these two, thought that the whole thing with Dormammu was a lot longer than it was. It's literally like the last 5 minutes of the film.
Yeah, it's the same.
I thought, is this all we get of Dormammu? I was really surprised at that. Yes, the time loop thing. I think that's probably what it was for me. I was so enjoying the time loop thing. I didn't actually stop to think, actually, so the big bad in this is Dormammu, but he's only in for like 3 minutes. And Mads Mikkelsen, who I absolutely adore, I love Hannibal, is probably fairly ill-served in the thing as a villain. So the fact that he's the second in command... of the film, that we don't get much about him, and then we get Dormammu for 3 minutes, and that is a bit of a concern for me, if I was being honest. I don't know if that's another thing that you sort of picked out, but that for me is probably the biggest element to me that I was surprised by.
Absolutely, I was very similar, and I think, you know, the first time I watched it round, I really enjoyed it, and the whole Dormammu sequence comes in, and it's a great sequence. It's like, it's clever Doctor Strange tricking him. Movie ends, I come out, it's like, oh, what fun, what larks I've had. And then, like I say, I've watched it a couple of times since. I watched it, you know, a couple of months ago just for fun, but to be honest, when I watched it then, I wasn't paying that much attention. I was, you know, I was pottering and I was eating and I was, you know, checking my phone and looking up to see Benedict Wong do his funny lines and then, you know, having a chuckle and all that kind of stuff. So watching it this afternoon, like properly, critically watching it, it got to that end sequence and I was like, oh, that's it. Like he dies like four or five times. And especially now in your brain, you think of stuff like Heaven Sent.
Yeah.
And you think about the... how emboldening and how triumphant it is when that relentless sequence of death, and then you suddenly realize what's happening, and you realize that it's this amazing plan. Whereas in this, I'd forgotten that he basically walks up, he puts the spell on his arm before he starts that sequence. He kind of goes hee, and then he starts doing it, and I'd forgotten that. I'd forgotten that it's like it's completely telegraphed. And then, he kind of like does it three or four times, and Dormammu's like, "I don't like doing this. Release me, please." It's like, it's like in my brain, it's this massive long sequence of all these desperate deaths, and Dormammu basically like begging, and Steven just repeatedly coming back, no, until he's, but like, no, it's like four or five times, and then poof, that's it. It's definitely. It's definitely disappointing on a rewatch. Yeah.
I get what they were trying to do with it, in that, you know, that Doctor Strange is in his own time loop and his own kind of frustrations with the fact that he's just completely in this loop. He can't get out of it. and he has to make a bargain or compromise, or, you know, the fact that he knows he can't get his old life back, he's got to forge a new one. So I understand the kind of like the mirroring of that, but as you say, it's the fact that it's only 2 or 3 minutes, and that I think the prisoner line, like you say, and the free me, is probably the best part of it from a thematic point of view. I do love the actual way it happens, and the 2 or 3 minutes of, you know, it says, "I've come to bargain."
Mamu, dead.
I've come to bargain. I do love it, but I was just surprised, and I think that there is that as I say, that Doctor Strange was locked in that time loop for a while, and he's managed to get himself out and freed himself from it. So I like that, but I just found it fascinating that it wasn't as big as I thought it was.
It's weird. I had exactly the same, and I love the dialogue, the lines that he has, where he basically says, "Well, I can be trapped here forever. As long as I'm trapped here forever, you're trapped here forever," which means that the people of Earth are fine. And I love that. This big kind of like, oh, wow, he has made the selfless act. He's finally made the ultimate. And then very quickly you realise that, well, no, actually, it's a trick.
Yeah.
Steven never thought he was going to have to do that forever and forever, which is kind of interesting because I think it fits the character. It fits the arrogance. That he wouldn't sacrifice himself. He would find a workaround, which he did, even though he presents it as sacrificing himself. But I don't know if the movie really knows which one it's presenting us with.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that the film is saying he was never planning to sacrifice. He had this plan all along. I think the film is being earnest when he says, "I can do this forever and they'll be safe." And so it's a little bit of a, I don't know whether I have to work on headcanon to sort of like to dismiss that as his arrogance. And I think on this rewatch, there are several points in the movie, as much as I do enjoy it, there are several points in the movie where I'm like, I don't know if the film is saying this or I've just interpreted it as that. And I'm not convinced you are saying that.
Yeah.
I think you're doing a comedy beat. I think you're doing an action beat. I think you're saying one thing, and it's maybe only my perception of the character or my knowledge of the comic book, which is making me perceive it in another way. Maybe. I mean, I suppose that's the same for all art with every human being on the face of the planet. But I think there are some key points in this movie where you could make that argument. And that is one of them, I think, at the end there.
Yeah, definitely. I think going back to the Kathmandu stuff, you know, jumping all over the place because we're at the end. That's it. Thank you very much. Goodbye. the kind of like the mentor and the mentorship stuff like that, as I say, the kind of the journey, the hero's journey that we're on here, that he's been broken down. He needs to find himself. He heads over to the East. That you get to this point where, you know, he needs to be taught something new, and, you know, you get a mentor, and surprisingly enough, the mentor will die in the future. But the opening of the eyes and the cup of tea stuff like that, I thought was really, really good. And and then obviously you get this really abstract aspect to it. And I think part of what I like about this film is that a lot of the times when the scenes are done, each scene is fairly different to each other. So like I said at the beginning, it was kind of grayscale with the flashy yellow. The scenes here, you've got the astral projection kind of being shown in a way, so we know what that is for later on in the hospital. But you do get this interplay between the Ancient One and Strange, where, you know, you've got like the cup of tea. What have you put in it? Is it LSD? Is it this? And just that. And again, one of the story elements that they've tried to put in the film is this kind of science versus, you know, this kind of thing, isn't it? It's kind of done that. And there was a bit of controversy over bringing in Tilda Swinton for this film as well, wasn't they? And I know that I've read a couple of articles of late where it was saying things like, "I think they were damned if they did or damned if they don't, if they do."
I think that was ultimately the situation, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, so I thought that was a difficult one, I think, to get that into place. But yeah, the kind of introduction to the world that Doctor Strange didn't know, and the kind of like the 2001 elements as well, I suppose is the best way to put it. How did you find all those things? You know, it's like the learning of the Matrix, isn't it? It's kind of that kind of style part of the film, isn't it, really?
Well, I think that the sort of the initial moment where we sort of we meet the Ancient One and Tilda Swinton is there and he has his sort of eyes opened or his eye opened. Yeah, I agree. I think that's fantastic. I think that's really good. Then I think the sort of the next 10 or 15 minutes of the film, which is almost a kind of a really long training montage.
Yeah.
It's almost a training montage.
Oh, someone's got to put No Easy Way Out on that. There's no shortcut home.
See that? Well, that's the thing about it. I think that a lot of that sequence, we have seen that so often,
yeah,
in movies, that it's very easy for it to become stale or tedious. Well, I think the film really walks the line. I do think there's something about it. Like I said, for me, I feel like there's a kind of an 80s aesthetic to the film, which kind of lets it get away with that when they're doing training montage-y type stuff. I think that if the film had been a little bit more, if it had felt slightly more grounded in like contemporary reality, or if it had been a little bit more, even a little bit more in step with the other Avengers movies, then I think that all the stuff with him training and him learning, I think it could have been a bit dry and a bit cheesy, a bit goofy.
Yeah.
But I think that because the film's kind of so isolated from the other MCU movies, and because it has this slightly sort of like old school vibe to it, I think they kind of get away with it. It is a little bit of a dip in the movie for me. Yeah. Although I do like the, you know, I like the moment where he goes from being, you know, scruffy Benedict to being kind of Doctor Strange Benedict, and starts taking it, you know, as like I was saying earlier about, you know, he decides to be the best. I do kind of like that moment, that flip side there. But I think that is the weakest spot in the film, for me at least. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it gave me an opportunity to skip quite a few 15 seconds. So just to keep me in time for today, but I would agree. I think I like aspects of it. As I say, it has that very kind of Matrix trainee kind of, you know, 80s was probably not, I wasn't thinking of that, but I can see what you're saying there. It definitely felt more like a Matrix kind of thing to me. It's like it's the I know Kung Fu kind of aspect of it. I did like some elements of it. It didn't have the pacing that I thought it would if it was a little bit quicker. So the things like on Everest, for example, the relics, which obviously will come into play with the cloak, some of that was kind of like it just seemed lethargic a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I know what you mean, especially the Everest thing. Actually, watching it today, I was thinking in my brain that was a far more energetic sequence.
Yeah,
it's like, actually, this is a really long, like, from the point of her kind of interjecting and sort of taking him on this, like, wow, this is a really long time being spent on this. And even though that's his kind of turning moment, I didn't actually think it had enough of an impact. Although I like that point where he had his shave and he starts taking it seriously. It's a weirdly elongated, lethargic, I think you just said. That's the perfect way to describe it.
So, yeah, I mean, I have to say, I found it was okay, but it just, as I say, it just felt a little bit lethargic. I did like there's little jokes in there, like some of the levity, like the Shambhala thing, where it's like, is that thing, that's the Wi-Fi password?
That's a brilliant joke. It's like, I don't care. Like, that's just a fantastic joke, beautifully delivered.
Yeah, and that around that scene is when we see the watch, isn't it? Because the watch becomes, you know, even like sort of the trailer of the newest film starts with that watch. So, you know, that's how it that literally kicks in, where you see a reflection of Strange in the watch. So I think that just reminding us about Christine at that point is probably a good thing to do. And then obviously, as you say, the training montage of going deeper into the library and finding out all the library stuff, that was fun. But I think you're right in that it did slow down a little bit too much there for me. And until, you know, really until you get to the kind of Mads Mikkelsen's character kind of going against the three inner sanctums, when it really kicks in. And I think those scenes worked a lot better, and it kind of sped up a little bit more at that point. I mean, what do you make to his character overall? Because I know I mentioned about, like, sort of, is he a bit too stock? Is there enough? Because all we get in those scenes in the Sanctum is when he's, like, tied up and he basically says about the darkness and the Ancient One actually using that as well. Do you think he could have been fleshed out a little bit more?
Yeah, I think it's one of these interesting things that the MCU often comes under flak for having poorly developed villains. I don't absolutely agree with that perspective. And I think especially with certain films and what you're doing and the characters you're trying to present, I think that sometimes a villain, to a certain extent, a villain is not as important. Especially a film like this, I would argue that it's Steven's journey is the most important part. It's his progression. So actually the villain is not that important. That said, it is an underdeveloped villain. We get some information about it. We basically keep getting reminded that he's a zealot, which is a nice kind of like byword to say he's not necessarily an evil villain, but he believes something and he's not going to change his mind. So zealot's a nice kind of like cover word.
Yeah.
I do get the sense that the character is, he's not darkness. He's not evil. He's just wrong.
Mm.
You know, he wants something different. He wants something better because he's had loss and suffering. So I think the film gives you enough to make that conclusion. But I could have had a little bit more. But then it's hard to say exactly what more, because I don't... If I'd seen scenes of him, you know, weeping at his dead wife's grave or holding his child's teddy, then that might have actually... That would have been kind of naff, and you know, you could have, again, you've got some fridging going on. So it's a tricky one, because I think I don't mind a villain who's basically a force of nature, and I don't mind a villain who has, you know, depth and character and reason and motivation. And I think this is sort of somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's not quite one or the other. But I think, as with a lot of things, and I will talk about Christine, I'm sure, in a minute, a bit more. But I think Mads Mikkelsen covers the cracks because he's so good. And actually, there's a point, not to get ahead of ourselves. So it is a joke, the whole Mr. Doctor joke,
which I think
is a really brilliant joke. I think it's really funny, and the goofiness of it. And it's, you know, I know some people hate it when the MCU kind of like hang a hat on things, but it's like, no, I like it. You know, it's like Mr. Doctor, right? Mr. Doctor. It's strange. Well, you know, who am I to judge? It's a great little bit of byplay back and forward. But then later on, when he has captured him, he's still calling him Mr. Doctor.
Yeah.
But Mads Mikkelsen is doing it so straight, so seriously. And he does it a couple of times, and Strange finally corrects him and says, no, my name is Strange. I am a doctor. And it does, like Mads Mikkelsen, he doesn't break a beat. And that's actually, I think, is a brilliant performance moment. And it's a brilliant character moment. Off the back of that joke, when he gets corrected, there's no goofiness. He doesn't make another joke. He now has the correct information. He changes how he's addressing him. And he says, well, as a doctor, you must want to heal things. I think that's a brilliant, brilliant moment.
I like the flick into, like, so he goes, oh, right, I need to talk science to you. Yeah, exactly.
And I think there are a couple of little moments like that. And I think the performance from Mads Mikkelsen is he's so good. He's like effortlessly good. I think that just keeps it above water.
Mm.
It definitely is an underdeveloped villain, but I don't mind that too much in this context because of what I said about, I think, Steven's journey, I think, is actually more important than the villain.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I remember, like, watching it and thinking, like having that conversation in my head that, well, actually, thinking about this is point of view storytelling, and that the point of view we're looking at is Strange, so we're not going to see too much, because we don't really see too much of his character at all, really, outside of Strange's viewpoint. So, and I think that's probably telling that's the way they wanted to go with it. That it was more, this is Stephen Strange's film. Yes, we've got this villain, but he's the villain to the Ancient One. He's not the villain to Stephen Strange. Stephen Strange just gets in the way, basically. It's not like, I joked about Khan before. It's not like Kirk and Khan. It's not them, you know, two massive loggerhead people at loggerheads who have had history between them and, you know, they're on this like sort of submarine warfare kind of thing, you know, across the airwaves. Stephen Strange just happens to get in the way. it's kind of like, oh, right, okay, well, this is something else is happening. So the credentials of Dormammu, who is a much, much bigger villain, kind of like it kind of interplays with that a little bit. That is it, because are we trying to remove Dormammu from the hand of this like kind of ethereal kind of villain in the essence of like you can't really sense it in a way that Doctor Strange probably would be, because it's not a reality thing. It's kind of, you know, it's beyond the realm, so it's not like, you know, something you can just grasp onto. It is a massive head. It's like the massive face of Boar in Doctor Who, isn't it? It's kind of like even bigger than that. So it's stuff like that where it's kind of like, you know, it's probably trying to play the realms and not play too much of the one-to-ones. And I'm not sure if it... And I think you've said the right lines there. It's like he's covering the cracks a little bit, because if they give in to a lesser actor, I think it probably would have looked a bit campy, or it might not have worked. And... you know, you've got like the edginess of the way that Mads works and actually delivers lines that actually works a lot better. I think the other characters, is it Mordor, the one that...
Yes.
Yeah, so what do you make to that arc then? Because part of the reason why we're talking about this is that Mads has let himself have something go through him. And, you know, Stephen Strange is kind of like sort of doing the same with like the Infinity Stone and, you know, and this idea that, you know, he needs to like sort of let something in and there'll be consequences. And then we also get the you know, obviously the end credit scenes as well, where he's completely gone the other way. Do you think there's enough there? Do you think that the consequences stuff, is that played enough for you? It's I find it an intriguing element to the story and an interesting mix, and I like it from a story writing point of view, that there's this third wheel thing that's happening that's kind of sideswipes you a little bit. What do you think to this idea of that?
So I'm almost on board with it.
Okay.
I don't quite feel like the film does that arc service. There are a couple of brilliant moments, like very, very early on, where Mordor's saying to the Ancient One, I think she's saying something about, you know, I can't lose someone else to the dark. And Mordor kind of says, well, you haven't lost me. And there's a brilliant, like Tilda Swinton just does this amazing kind of look where she's almost kind of like, can't quite make eye contact with him for a second.
Yeah.
Which I think is brilliant early on, because it's the fact that she knows that she's lost him.
Yeah.
She already knows. She wanted Stephen Strange. She's known Stephen Strange is going to be there for centuries. It's like she knows all of this. So I love that moment. It's very subtle. It's like you say about the you know, the show not tell.
Mm.
But I think it's a very subtle moment where he says, you've not lost me. And the look on her face is kind of like, oh, well, no, I have.
Yeah.
But she's not going to say that to him. So I think there's enough seeded, and he has some nice moments where he is just a little bit fanatical and a little bit pious about things. And, you know, especially when we first meet him, he kind of references the fact that he used to be disrespectful and this kind of stuff. So I'm almost on board with it. And then at the end, when he finds out that she's been using dark powers, and he's kind of like, well, that's the whole point. This is what... So the idea that he's had what he believes in ripped away, I think is a perfectly legitimate motivation.
Yeah.
But I don't think that the film sells it enough. And for all we've been talking about, you know, show not tell, I almost feel like I needed a moment of him almost losing his shit.
Yeah.
Because he basically just kind of goes, oh, I'm really annoyed about this. And she's using evil powers. Oh dear. How annoying. Like, that's basically it. And then they go and they fight, and you know, Stephen reverses time, and then he disappears up to Mordu and up to everyone's name starts with an M, but he like disappears off.
Yeah.
And then he comes back and they're like, come on, Stephen, we need to fight. He never seems that broken up about it. And I feel like I needed a moment where he almost loses his shit and Stephen needed to talk him down.
It needed to be when they're talking about the bit where it says that when Stephen Strange took a life. But again, it's more of a point of view for Stephen rather than him.
This is the thing. I think because the film is so focused on Stephen, which is fine and appropriate, it does mean that the other characters don't get so well serviced. For Mads, for the villains, I don't think that's a problem. I don't mind that. For Christine, I keep saying I'm going to talk about Christine. I'm sure we're going to talk about Christine.
I'm just holding off. I'm holding off. I'm like going, I'll put that down the list.
It's like Christine. Christine we'll get to. But I think with Mordo, there's a sort of, the problem is that he really is, he needed to have been set up because he is a proper full on, like, arch villain.
Yeah.
For Strange in the comics, and we needed a little bit more of the kind of Loki in Thor 1 to Avengers arc for him, because at the end of the first Thor, like, Loki, you know, Loki's antagonistic and you know, a wrong'un in that first movie, but he's not a full-on destroy the world villain.
Yeah.
But then at the end he's kind of like, he's just really upset and pissed off. And then when we see him again, when we meet him again, it kind of makes sense. Whereas with this, I feel like he's just a bit annoyed. And then suddenly we see a post scene where he's like, I'm going to destroy all the sorcerers. And it's like, whoa, where'd that come from? I know you're upset, but this doesn't seem like the right course of action. So it's a bit of a sticking point for me.
Yeah. And
I think they almost get it right, but they don't stick the landing, basically.
Yeah, okay, Christine. Let's talk about Christine, because I've held you for an hour and 16 minutes, so that time of recording.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not like a deliberate, but I think there's a lot to say about Christine. Yeah. So on the surface of it, I think that it is very easy to say that Christine is an underwritten character, and I wouldn't get into a fist fight with anyone who felt that way about her. But coming back to everything I've been saying about this film is about Steven, and it's about his journey. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing that we haven't had more time on Christine. Mm. And again, I come back to what I was saying about Mads being a great actor. I think that Rachel McAdams is so good. She's so charming. And there's something I find very grounded about her performance in this, that I think, again, she papers over the cracks of this. There are elements to this that I really like. In fact, if our relationship with these two characters, you know, were to continue on this path, I'd kind of like it, because I feel like, as I said, I think probably earlier when I was ranting about something else, I do kind of feel like they have a really good friendship.
Yeah.
And it's a friendship based on them, you know, it not working out. And you do get the sense that Strange is, you know, probably a bit more attached to her, and that she's kind of moved on more appropriately. And she's the only person who's there for him, and this kind of stuff. There is love and affection there. And of course, the watch, you know, it's a very nice thing that we see. He's got all these expensive, fancy watches at the beginning. And then at the end, the only thing that he's kept, the only thing that he hasn't sold on, is this, you know, relatively cheap watch with an inscription from her. So there was obviously a point in their lives where they had a strong connection, loving connection, romantic connection. But it's passed, and it's passed quickly, and it's passed potentially quite a while ago.
Yep.
And I'm quite down with that relationship. I like the idea. I don't always have to have a romantic relationship with my key characters. Yep. So the fact that she's perhaps a little underwritten in that respect, I'm kind of okay with. I give it a pass for all the other reasons that I've talked about. And again, it's this thing of, like, you know, people often talk about actors being wasted. It's like, oh, Rachel McAdams was wasted in that role. She hardly does anything. She's in at the beginning, in at the end, a little bit in the middle. Oh, she's wasted. It's like, well, she's not wasted, because a less good actor, or a less charismatic actor, or a less appropriate actor would not have bought as much to the role.
Yeah.
And you have someone as good as Rachel McAdams, as likable as Rachel McAdams. You might hate her, obviously. Yeah. Someone as likable as Rachel McAdams. It does allow you to shortcut, and it does allow you to maybe not consciously or deliberately underwrite a character, but it means that she can bring a lot to what she has. She can imbue it with a lot. And there's no point where I'm watching it and I'm thinking, oh, poor Rachel McAdams. She's got so little to work with. It's like, yeah, but they've given that little to somebody who's done a lot with it.
Yeah, it's what she doesn't do that actually adds the effect to it in some ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
All that said, though, I feel like with the next movie coming up, they're going to really crank up the idea of them being a huge romantic pairing, because I feel like for I don't know if you've watched it, but for anyone who has watched it, the What If series, which I really enjoyed.
It was actually my favorite episode out of a lot of them, the strange one.
It was so good. It was so good. A lot about it that I really liked. But that really was almost a retcon of their relationship. And it's multiverse, it's What If, it's all this kind of stuff. But I feel like it was doing a really cheeky job of like back injecting the romance into their characters. Mm. And I think that going on from this, it's like, I think that's going to be a much bigger part of their characters. So I think they've been a bit cheeky.
Right.
I think the film doesn't leave us on a point where they are destined to be together. It doesn't do that. I really liked the fact that, you know, even when she parts from him, she kind of kisses him on the cheek. There's an affection. There's a different kind of love. I really liked that. I think that's all getting thrown out the window, and they're going to be star-crossed lovers and all that kind of stuff, which, okay, I'm fine with that. But I think when we watch all the films in succession, we're going to go, oh, in this one, they're just mates, and in that one, they've loved each other forever. So I think that it underserves the character in where the character's going to end up. In the context of the movie, I'm down with it. Yeah,
definitely. I think also as well with the scenes that are quite pivotal in the action pieces where he has to go to the hospital. I thought that they were really good. Her reactions to the astral projection, to the, you know, the broom falling over after he's gone through the actual portal and things like that. I thought those worked really effectively as well. So there was enough levity for me in those scenes. It was enough to like humanize Strange to a degree as well. You know, that out of everything that he's got, he does have that underlying like sort of you know, at that time, as you say, maybe platonic stroke, you know, we were barely even lovers comment, you know. Mm-hmm. So the fact that they, as you say, have flirted with the idea, and it's not quite there yet, if that was going to be the case. And you know, and the fact that she has, you know, this strong bond with him and this strong relationship, and she has strength in her own self to, you know, think of those second when early, like the beginning of the film, where, you know, she's like wanting that second opinion, but he's saying you just want a second. You know, I can't remember exactly how he says it.
Oh, it's like you had a second opinion, you just wanted a competent one. I think it's something like that, isn't it?
But that's like sort of like the fact that she's wanting that second opinion is like true to her. That she just like, no, I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm going to go and see someone else, and I'm going to make sure that this person survives, kind of thing. And it gives her that characterization, I think. Yeah, well, I think other than that, is there anything that I've... But maybe the Ancient One, I think, maybe we need to speak a little bit more about, because she did, imbue, I think, well, probably the wrong word to use, but kind of like she did take you know, stuff from the Dark Realm to portray her life, and obviously she sees the death before, and those scenes on the balcony, which kind of like sort of said that she couldn't see any further. There was nothing that she could see that was any further from what she did. So she knows this is her own mortality. And the lines that are used, and I've been reading some psychology or listening to some psychology podcasts recently, who said the same thing really about, would you want to live forever? Well, no, because you've got to have death as a finite thing to make things have meaning. And they kind of filter on quite a lot of that in this film as well, which I found was quite fascinating. I've just been listening to something like that. So this idea that death is finite, and you know that everyone has an end to their story and stuff like that, I thought was an interesting little theme that permeated through this, even though it's not a main one. But the way the Ancient One was kind of portraying that, and everyone else was after this eternal life, you know, was interesting in itself, that, you know, the Ancient One has like let her guard down and allowed herself to be taken over to the dark side because of that.
Yeah, I think it's a nice side to the character. It's a nice element to the character, and I think it's also quite an interesting thing to inject into the wider MCU, because comic book characters live forever.
Yeah,
you know, Superman's nearly 80, you know, they live forever, not just in terms of the media that we consume, but in the actual comics and stuff. Mm. You know, it's like they die, they come back, they could die, they come back. It's like all the time. And I think that it's quite a nice element in this. It's just to sort of be reminded that people don't live forever and shouldn't live forever. This concept, like you say, of things having a finite existence, and that's what gives them meaning.
Yeah.
We can apply that to everything, not just our lives, but we can apply it to experiences that we have. We can apply it to the media. We can apply it to characters within that media. So I think it's a really nice thing for them to touch on. And I think that what this does is it gives you this idea of a character who has, like you say, she's turned to the dark side for a source of power to elongate her life because she feels that that is the right thing to do for the greater good. And I think it's pretty much presented that she has, everything she has done has been for the greater good. She hasn't done anything bad. You know, her slip to the dark side hasn't been a literal one. She isn't a villain. Yeah. She hasn't been pulling strings. But she used a bad power source, which is something she's told other people not to do, and someone else has copied her and it's corrupted him. So that is her penance, I guess. You know, that is what she's done. I really like that scene. I'm not a massive Tilda Swinton fan.
Right. Okay.
I kind of flip-flop a little bit. It's like I always want to like her more than I do. And in some films, I think she's fantastic, you know, whatever it is she's in. In some things, I think she's fantastic. And in some things, I find her really annoying. but in this, I really enjoyed her. I think she's got a real lightness of touch about the performance. We touched on it earlier about the damned if they do, damned if they don't. It was a really difficult role for them to cast. Yeah. I think they probably made the right choice. I suspect that now... they wouldn't. I think that now, as a creative body, they could have done an ethnically different character, and they could have done it sensitively and appropriately. Yeah. But I think even though short few years ago, I think they just didn't know how to do that without it being offensive. And I think what they did was maybe it was cowardly, maybe it was easy, but I think they sort of took the safe route. Because the criticisms of, you know, I guess the criticisms of whitewashing, if you like, on the role are much easier for them to defend and much easier for us to understand as an audience than had they had some terrible Eastern prophet Asian caricature coming in. I think it's... and I think choosing Tilda Swinton was a good choice because she's weird.
Yeah.
Like, Tilda Swinton is a weird actor. We know that she's weird and she plays slightly weird characters. You know, if this film had been made 30 years ago, it would have been David Bowie playing the role. It's that kind of thing, I think. So I think, I enjoy her. I enjoy the arc that she gets. I do, though, think that the film doesn't quite earn the emotional impact that her death has.
Yeah,
I don't think that the characters have a strong enough connection. Even Strange, I don't feel like they have a strong enough connection. I don't feel like we as an audience have a strong enough connection for the massive emotional impact which is presented when she dies.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But as you said as well, though, I do really love the dialogue on the balcony. I think that is really nice, and I like the fact that things slow down. And I think there's something a little bit prophetic for later MCU movies, and I do enjoy that, and I enjoy the point and the meaning of her death. But yeah, I don't think it earned the impact that it's supposed to have.
No, I would totally agree with that. I think it's because she's always that kind of aloof character where Strange is kind of like almost twice removed, and you know that yes, they've had a couple of mentorship things, and it goes back to, as I say, to the hero's journey, and that you've got to have that aspect of like the mentor then dies and then he realizes and then has to make a change and makes the change, and then at the end of it has come out irrevocably changed compared to where he was at the beginning of the film. But it doesn't quite land. I think you're absolutely right there. It doesn't quite land. Despite all the actual efforts for it to like sort of work, and it does work. It's efficient in what it does. It just doesn't have the emotional resonance, I think, that it was trying to get there, really. So, right. Is there anything else? I mean, we could talk about the actual technicality of the stuff. There's things like the Inception stuff and all of that stuff. But I think, you know, I think that's all on screen to tell, really. There's nothing much more we can really say that this thing. I know that, as I said, I mentioned before, what Tenet, seeing the end of the film, kind of feels a little bit like Tenet now when you look at it and go, oh, yeah, I've seen that in Tenet recently. you know, and I think some of the origin story, like you mentioned, Iron Man, I think I was thinking Batman in a few bits, and I was like, okay, you know, thinking about Batman Begins and stuff like that, potentially the way that Batman Begins was done with Christopher Nolan. But yeah, I don't think there's anything else. Is there anything else that jumps out at you that we might have missed that we need to briefly discuss at all?
No, I mean, there are kind of two things that I guess I would want to touch on, which I'll do very quickly. Yep. but one is off what you're kind of saying about the visual and the style of it. I have to confess, watching it again today, I was less impressed with it.
Right, okay.
And I don't know how much of that is to do with having watched it in a cinema. I mean, I've watched it at home a couple of times since then, but obviously in the cinema, it's like, this is fantastic. This is amazing. The kaleidoscope, very, you know, very sort of like Jack Kirby visuals going on in a lot of it. But watching it again, I was like, actually, this is a little bit more, it's a little bit more pedestrian.
Right, okay.
than I remembered it being. Now, I don't know whether that's because it's been seen in other places, but I actually thought that the Doctor Strange visual aesthetic, you know, all that kaleidoscopy stuff, I actually think it's better in other people's movies. So I think that the latest Spider-Man movie, and actually even the previous Spider-Man movie with the Mysterio stuff, I think does that better. And I think that the Ant-Man movies kind of do the Jack Kirby stuff better, the Quantum Realm stuff better. So as much as I still like the film, like watching it again, I was like, actually, this twirly swirly stuff doesn't look as good as it looks in other people's movies. Right. But maybe that's just, you know, Scott Derrickson, you know, was a good choice for this. You know, as a horror director, I didn't really know his work before this, but you know, he's a horror director. And maybe he was the right person to kind of like open that gate.
Yeah.
But now looking at it, I'm kind of like, I think other people have done it better since. But that's not to dismiss it. It's still fantastic. And how you were saying about, you know, earlier on, it's kind of, it still feels a little grounded in the real world. And then it gets bigger, and the reverse sequence with the sort of the reverse explosion at the end, I think is a brilliant sequence. But I do think watching this now is like, actually, overall, the directing, it's a well-directed film, and all the things we've kind of complimented it on, I think are definitely down to the director. It's down to the person in charge. But I think as a director, I don't think I find him that engaging.
Yeah, okay.
I think it's like, it's really well and competently made, and it was he was probably the right person. But I am now very excited, not just that it's Sam Raimi, but I'm excited to see somebody else do these characters, because I think they'll do it better.
Well, as you say, I think we started the episode here with you know, how it's a strong, solid introduction. If you looked at Batman Begins compared to The Dark Knight Rises, it's chalk and cheese, and that's the same director.
Mm.
You find that thing. I think some of the Inception stuff, I think there's certain scenes which look very Inception-y, but don't have the attitude of Nolan. And this, obviously, as you can tell, I'm a bit of a Nolan fanboy anyway. But
yeah.
But at the same time, there's moments in some of the actual action sequences where they're jumping through things and they're landing through holes, and then the whole thing warps around them and things like that.
Mm.
It's expertly done. I'm not dissing it by any stretch of the imagination. I think it's wonderful. I watched it in IMAX, the IMAX version, the one, the experience one that keeps going to, mm-hmm. like, I think it must be, it's not quite 1.85 ratio. I think it may be slightly smaller than that, actually, maybe 1.9, I think, maybe. But it is around that 1.85 aspect, and it shortens down during other parts of the movie. So watching it in 4K is nice. You know, don't get me wrong, it's lovely. But yeah, I see what you're saying. I think the middle sequence is when it goes through the kind of like the hands going through, and the fingers are coming out of the hands and stuff like that. That kind of wasn't the best. I prefer the Inception stuff and potentially the time stuff more than that middle section, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I think there's definitely something there, and it's fun. But I think I would argue that yeah, other directors have done that better in other MCU movies.
Absolutely.
Even though this kind of like introduced us to a lot of it.
Well, I think that we'll call it to the end then, unless you've got anything else you want to say. And we shall look forward to my coverage of Multiverse of Madness in the next couple of weeks. So thank you very much, Robert, for coming on.
Thank you
very much.
Where
can people find you online? I know you've mentioned a couple of things you're up to recently, and where can people find you?
So in terms of We Made This, I'm the co-host on the You Have Been Watching British Sitcom podcast, and we should be getting some more episodes of that out over the summer. And then I tend to just pop up here and there. I guest host or guest chat on Real Talk quite a few times, various different movies. We've done a two-part Sam Raimi top 10 for Real Talk, so you should definitely check that out if you're excited for Multiverse of Madness, or even if you're not and you just like Sam Raimi, or if you don't like Sam Raimi, because I'll change your mind. But if you want to find out what I'm doing, the best thing to do is I'm on Twitter. It's Four Ducks, so it's F-O-R-D-U. I'll say that again. It's Four Ducks, which is F-O-R-D-U-C-K-S. Whatever I'm doing, I promote it out there. I repeat it out there. So that's the best place to find it.
Excellent. Well, as I say, listen, look out for our podcast 616 coverage of Multiverse of Madness once I watch it next Thursday at time of recording. I do run a cinema, actually, strangely enough, and, you know, if it suddenly becomes available beforehand, I might be testing it. But we'll see what happens. So listen out for that. But otherwise, you can catch me on the Star Trek Picard podcast. Robert, you were actually on a couple of weeks ago for the Star Trek Picard coverage that we're doing on Make It So, the Star Trek Picard podcast. We're up to episode 9 coming up soon. And then the finale will be coming up as well. So find me on there at Jean-Luc Poddard on Twitter. You can find me generally on Twitter at R Muldrake. It's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. You'll find all the things that I'm doing. I'm on the X-Cast, which is an X-Files podcast. Robert, I know you've had links to Red Dwarf. I'm on the Red Dwarf Shipwrecked and Comatose podcast. So yeah, loving life on there. We've just completed Series 6. We're about to start recording Series 7 soon. But there's a lot of specials on the Smegazines and things like that coming out. So if you are a Red Dwarf fan, then please feel free to come and find us over there at Red Dwarf Pod. But you can find all the other stuff that I'm on my main Twitter feed. But Podcast 616 isn't the only podcast on the network. There's plenty of us to hear. You've heard some already from myself and Robert. And we've got a few clips of other podcasts that are on the network. So feel free to listen to that at the end of this. But yeah, again, Robert, thank you very much for coming on. I hope you enjoy the film when it comes out. And we'll see you again on Podcast 616 in the near future, I would hope.
Thank you very much. Yes, I can't wait for it.
Well, all that leaves me to do is to say, I've come to bargain.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Frame to frame.
Well, for Sean's benefit, these are all ex-players. Just so you know, mate. Yes, they used to be NBA players.
If you don't know who Shaquille O'Neal is, there's a problem.
Okay, let me just announce that right then, there's a problem. Because just to put my cards on the table, I did not know that these were real basketball players until halfway through the movie. And then the joke only hit me halfway through. I was like, oh, now I understand where the gag's coming from. Because I thought...
You've never heard of Shaquille O'Neal?
I mean, I've heard of him, but I didn't know that was him. So yeah, it's probably not really much of an answer, is it really? It's pretty lame.
Chucky Vision, a Chucky podcast.
This was their first film as Full Moon. Before that, they were Empire Pictures for a while, and they did a few movies, produced a few movies. This was the first big hit for Full Moon. I think it was just this film for 89, and then in 90, they produced like 3 films, and then in 91, they produced like 5 films, and then in 92, they were producing like 10 films all in one year.
Yeah, that's a lot.
They exploded during the early 90s, and they've still been kind of like that today, like announced in like 2019, and then it was done during 2020. They announced the Deadly 10, these 10 movies they were going to produce and create in one year, and they were going to live stream all the behind the scenes and stuff. Sadly, they only made like 2 of those films because then Corona hurt, so like couldn't actually push out as much as they used to. That's kind of their spirit, kind of this independent spirit. You know, Troma does it as well, a weird mix between quality and quantity.
Academy Watch, a prestige film podcast.
Every other discipline in film comes from somewhere else. Acting comes from theatre, writing comes from writing, you know, like music comes from music. Like everything comes from somewhere else except editing. Editing is the one thing that is intrinsically filmic about film, and to not show that is just a hilarious disrespect to
it's completely
editors.
It's completely insane. That's the one cat, like, I mean don't get me wrong, I hate cutting any of them, but I can kind of squint and sort of kind of see if you've got to pick ones to eliminate, like eliminating some of these technical ones. And I mean, score seems like a bridge too far to me, but, you know, fine. But like you said, editing is just such an intrinsic part of the art.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.